You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll learn about a program that was piloted here in Wisconsin that researchers hope will provide better recovery treatment for people who drive drunk. We'll learn more in a bit.
First, President Trump's nominee for director of the FBI testified earlier today in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee for his nomination hearing. Christopher Wray is a former assistant attorney general under George W. Bush. Here's a bit of his opening remarks.
If I am given the honor of leading this agency, I will never allow the FBI's work to be driven by anything other than the facts, the law, and the impartial pursuit of justice, period. Full stop.
Darren Samuelson joins us now. He's a senior White House reporter for Politico. Darren, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, how did Christopher Wray perform under the questioning?
He did pretty well. He's on his way to confirmation by the Senate. Typically, Senate confirmation is on an FBI director is pretty wide and bipartisan, and it looks like after today's hearing and about 5 hours of a pretty intense question. Points. Chris Wray satisfied most concerns of senators, and I think he's going to get confirmed.
How have some members of the Judiciary Committee spoken about him since testimony ended? What have their press conferences been like?
Well, they, again, feel like they got most of the answers that they were looking for. They were coming into this hearing wanting to hear about him being an independent, chief law enforcement officer for the United States. The FBI has been obviously over the last couple of years with respect to how it handled the Hillary Clinton email investigation. And James Comey and everything that, led to his ultimate firing was a lot of baggage that a lot of senators were hoping that Mr. Wray could satisfy their concerns. And, yeah, we heard that from Democrats, Senators Dianne Feinstein, Amy Klobuchar, Dick Durbin, Richard Blumenthal, all the Democrats indicating that they agreed that he was probably going to be able to pass muster and get their votes.
And Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, she asked Christopher Wray specifically about what he would do if he found out anyone was planning to tamper with Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation about Russian meddling in the 2016 election. And let's just hear a bit of what she had to say.
I would consider an effort to tamper with Director Mueller's investigation to be unacceptable and inappropriate, and would need to be dealt with very sternly and appropriately indeed.
So should we take those words at face value, or, would he waver?
I think you take his word at face value. Again, he's the chief law enforcement officer, assuming he gets confirmed. Obviously, there has been a lot of concern about whether President Trump, a lot of people have reported, was leaning on James Comey to pull back on that investigation, is interested in potentially, they've certainly tried to discredit Robert Mueller in the press, pointing out some of the people who are investigating the Russia investigation, have Democratic ties. And I think what Christopher Wray said today is if, things started to heat up and the president was moving toward trying to shut down that investigation, that he would do what he can to block it. And if he found things to be unethical, he would resign in protest as well. Obviously, President Trump does have the power. It would be very politically toxic if he did it. But, he could, and we were, kind of on deck on 4 or 5 about this a couple of weeks ago, could start to order people in the Justice Department to start to shut down that investigation. But as of this moment, it is cruising along. There's a lot of things happening by every count with respect to everything from Donald Trump Jr.'s emails the other day to, still looking into how President Trump, fired James Comey and the potential obstruction of justice that might have led to. So, at this point in time, Chris Wray, I think, alleviated concerns of senators that at least from his perspective, he could try and protect that investigation.
And we heard from former FBI Director James Comey in his testimony that President Trump had asked for his loyalty. And how did this loyalty oath come up in Wray's confirmation hearing?
Well, Wray said he was not asked for any such loyalty oath. Certainly, the idea of asking for one, like James Comey indicated, is quite shocking. And I would presume that after that, you know, assuming that what James Comey testified to be true, and the president has denied that even anything like that happened, but that you know, they are not doing that again. They're not asking people for a loyalty oath. It sounded like, according to what Christopher Wray testified today, it was really two meetings, kind of a get-to-know-you meetings with President Trump when he ultimately was offered the job. If you'll remember, a lot of people cycled through and were considered for the FBI job, including former Senator Joe Lieberman, a former head of the Transportation Security Administration. Several others were considered for that position, and ultimately they picked Chris Wray. Another thing Chris Wray indicated was that the appointment of Robert Mueller in that position that he has was one of the reasons he decided that he felt comfortable enough to take the job. Like, the heat that James Comey might have faced wasn't necessarily there, because now you do have a special prosecutor who has a lot of independence to do his work. And I think that made Christopher Wray feel like he could leave a private sector job, a very well-paying job, I'm sure, to go, you know, take a 10-year term at the FBI.
Talking right now with Darren Samuelson. He's senior White House reporter for Political, talking about testimony earlier today of Christopher Wray, who was before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He is President Trump's nominee for director of the FBI. Let's go into Wray's past just a bit and his background. There have been potential conflict of interest concerns from his law firm, King & Spalding, a firm where he's worked in the private sector, has ties to the Trump family and to Russia. Could these connections complicate his path to FBI director?
It doesn't sound like they will. I think he has acknowledged that if any of the clients that his firm and he directly worked on were to come up before the FBI, he would abstain from those cases. I believe that one of the major ones is with Gazprom, the major Russian electric outlet. And there was a question about that near the end of the hearing, but the senator who asked it didn't really sound like it was going to be a huge sticking point. Again, I think it's hard to know exactly where the FBI would end up having to deal with those issues. But certainly I think that, you know, Wray would take a leave of absence from that. King & Spalding does have some other ties with the Trump administration. I believe that you're referring to a gentleman who is actually like the chief ethics advisor, the outside ethics advisor to the Trump Organization, the company that the president's family still runs and manages and the president continues to have ownership of. They have an outside ethics advisor who works there who is from the same law firm. But, you know, this is a very large law firm, and hard to see exactly where the conflicts would be with the FBI director and that particular person who works at his old law firm.
We know Christopher Wray is 50 years old. What else do we know about his pedigree, his background?
Sure. Well, he served, for 4 years there, 5 years, excuse me, I think, in the early part of the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, where he headed the criminal division of the FBI. And that's a pretty, of the Justice Department, a pretty important position had a lot of major issues front and center sort of in the post 9/11 period, as the FBI made some dramatic changes from some of the sort of basic stuff that you might think about with respect to the J. Edgar Hoover crime fighting days, to dealing with counterterrorism, dealing with counter espionage,
9/11,
the arrival of cyber issues really weren't a big factor. He talked about that today, back in that period of time. Obviously, compared to where they are today, he's got a lot of things to learn up on. And he has, of course, spent the last 10, 11, 12 years, I believe it is now, in private practice at King & Spalding.
A lot of people describe Christopher Wray as low-key. He brought it up himself when he was asked about the circumstances under which he would resign. And very quickly here, let's hear a clip. You can also hear a bit from Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska in this clip as well.
I've heard many people describe me as understated and low-key. My kids would describe me more as just boring. But
there's some head nodding in row one.
Exactly.
Keep going.
I don't want to look back, but no one should mistake my low-key demeanor as a lack of resolve, as some kind of willingness to compromise on principle, because anybody who does would be making a very grave mistake.
What do we make of Wray's demeanor?
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and you got to think about it in a couple of different ways. Obviously, you know, going up against or the questions about how he would compare and contrast with President Trump, obviously seen as someone very with a very forceful personality, and you know, the FBI director, is certainly possible that they could clash with the White House and with the president, especially if this investigation into how the president, is in office takes us down that path. And so I think you do get a sense here from Christopher Wray that, you know, he's not going to back down from a fight. And yet at the same time, you know, talking about his low-key demeanor, one of the biggest criticisms of his predecessor, James Comey, was that he was a little bit more of a celebrity FBI director. You know, that famous press conference about a year ago when he, you know, announced all of the sort of reasons why Hillary Clinton could be indicted and then ultimately decided that she shouldn't be indicted. And really to even have a press conference like that was a lot of people rolled their eyes and wondered why was the FBI director making such a breach of protocol. I think Christopher Wray was trying to give a signal there that he is not quite the camera-hungry FBI director that James Comey may have come off as being back last year.
Darren, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Darren Samuelson, senior White House reporter for Politico. He joined us to talk about today's confirmation hearing for President Trump's nominee for the new FBI director, Christopher Wray. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Bowling may be the sport that made Milwaukee famous, but it was another Wisconsin town that supplied a key ingredient to the sport. Joe Hermelin from the Langlade County Historical Society brings us the story of the Vulcan bowling pin.
Well, the object we have here is a regulation-sized bowling pin. It was made in the late 1950s after Vulcan introduced its new patented Nile Tough Supreme coating. It was intended to prolong the life of bowling pins from the beating that they took. The choice of wood, pin dimensions, coating, was determined by the American Bowling Congress, which for many years was based in Milwaukee. I have bowled as a social activity. I never really took it all that seriously. But what really interested me was the story of the Vulcan Company and how it adapted to changing markets, because they came to Antico to make shoe lasts, and then it evolved into a bowling pin factory. So I was interested, how do you get from one product to another? The company, first of all, it started out in Ohio, and they made wooden shoe lasts. In 1919, they moved to Crandon, Wisconsin, because of an ample supply of maple wood. And then in 1925, they moved a little bit down the road to Antico. Antico also had an ample supply of maple trees. It was also a major railroad hub, and in those days, freight and people all traveled by rail. So Antico, in a way, was uniquely positioned for a company that wanted to make shoe lasts. They had the raw materials, and they had the means of shipping. So that's where the companies settled in. Starting in the 1940s, the demand decreased. And so they were looking for other products. And they tried their luck making gun stocks, golf clubs, furniture parts, sewing machine tops, shuffleboards, wooden high heels for women's shoes. They did get a contract to make a sort of rough cut bowling pin for Brunswick, which was a major bowling pin manufacturer. And then they decided to get into the bowling pin business themselves.
20 million men, women, and children in America are regular bowlers. They make the game our country's most popular participating sport.
After World War II, bowling really took off and automatic pin setters became popular, and the pins really took a beating. So that's when they came up with the coating. And in 1959, they finally got approval by the American Bowling Congress. And within 10 weeks, they produced their 50,000th pin. Bowling went through the same kind of, in the first half of the 20th century, that many other American kind of activities went through. At first, tournaments were for teams consisting of white males. And eventually, it took a little push, but the American Bowling Congress recognized African-American teams, minority teams, and women's teams into the fold of these bowling tournaments. In the 1950s, as more and more American homes became equipped with television, bowling tournaments on television became very popular. Milwaukee, its program called Bowling with the Champions, was one of their more popular TV shows. So in a way, all these little things about bowling reflect just the evolution of social norms within the country.
This story was produced with Wisconsin 101. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, drunken driving in Wisconsin is a big problem. The State Department of Transportation reports that in 2015, there were nearly 24,000 convictions for drunken driving offenses. That same year, 190 people were killed and nearly 2,900 were injured as the result of alcohol-related crashes.
While checkpoints or eagle-eyed law enforcement officials are one way of catching people driving under the influence, a new program called CARS aims to help officials assess underlying mental health issues that could be a factor in repeat DUIs. Wisconsin was one of the first places to pilot this program, which is now being released nationwide.
Sarah Nelson is the Associate Director of Research for the Division on Addiction at Cambridge Health Alliance in Massachusetts and has worked on the CARS program. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, explain to us how this program works.
Sure. CARS stands for the Computerized Assessment and Referral System, and it is basically a mental health screening and assessment tool that we've adapted for use with DUI programs of all kinds. So people who are working with DUI offenders either within the courts or within aftercare or substance use programs after a conviction.
And what are you trying to glean from this type of program? What information are you trying to get from these people with DUIs?
We've learned from our past research that many repeat DUI offenders, so people who continue to offend despite sanctions, often suffer from mental health issues beyond just substance use disorders, so anxiety disorders, depression. And we've also found that many of these individuals have never been screened or assessed for these problems and continue to experience them even after driver education programs or substance use related programs. So what we're hoping is that by using CARS, DUI programs can identify these issues and then help the individual offender seek and obtain additional treatment to deal with some of these underlying issues. We've found in our past work as well that the mental health issues relate to reoffense when you're talking about DUI behavior and other criminal behavior.
Why was Wisconsin chosen as one of the pilot states?
We were looking for a diversity of programs across the nation for our pilot project. So Wisconsin, we selected the IMPACT program because they provide alcohol and drug assessment to many of the individuals convicted of operating while intoxicated in Wisconsin and specifically within Milwaukee County. And so that program sees many DUI offenders from week to week, and they were able to use CARS with more than 150 individuals.
And so this is a computer program, and a person sits down and takes an assessment on the computer?
That's right. We actually worked with Dr. Ronald Kessler at the Harvard School of Public Health to adapt a very well-known and validated computerized diagnostic interview, the CD. So we worked with him to adapt that into a user-friendly program for DUI program. So it can be self-administered by the client, or it can be administered by an interviewer or a counselor. And then the counselor and the client together look at the report and determine the best next steps.
Talking right now with Sarah Nelson. She's Associate Director of Research for the Division on Addiction at Cambridge Health Alliance in Massachusetts. Talking about a new program, the acronym is CARS, that works to help officials assess underlying mental health issues that could be a factor in repeat DUIs. Sarah, what do we know about the role that mental health has in drunk driving?
We know that, as I said, many repeat DUI offenders suffer from mental health issues beyond substance use issues. We know from speaking with these offenders that for a lot of them, emotional issues can often trigger a relapse and can trigger some of this behavior as well. And we know that people with these mental health issues are more likely to have criminal reoffense than those without them, especially if they're going untreated.
This program was initially used in your state, Massachusetts. What did you find during that initial run?
We attempted to learn two things. First, we wanted to know if the tool was actually usable on the ground by programs that treat DUI offenders. So a lot of times researchers will come in and just try to drop a tool or a program. And what we wanted to do is develop this with the help of these DUI programs so that we could really develop something that was useful for them. So we worked with them to find something that was the right length of time, that had the right amount of flexibility. And what we found is that both the staff and the clients at those programs found the tool usable and also really appreciated the report that it generates. It's just kind of a click of a button. It generates a diagnostic report about those mental health issues.
Where does the program go from here?
We just last month put up a website, and we have released it publicly. So that's carstrainingcenter.org. And the tool itself is freely available, and there are training resources on that website. What we really hope to see is multiple DUI programs to begin using this tool to identify mental health issues among this population. Long term, we can also see CARS being used beyond just the DUI program. So substance use programs, other mental health programs, and even your primary care provider.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Nelson is the Associate Director of Research for the Division on Addiction at Cambridge Health Alliance in Massachusetts. She joined us today to talk about a program that's being piloted, or that was piloted in Wisconsin, to assess the link between mental health issues, addiction, and drunk and driving.
Unemployment is low in Wisconsin, really low by historical standards. It's flirting with the 3% mark now, a big improvement since the Great Recession.
But many of these jobs are in lower paying parts of the economy, and many workers in those fields haven't seen their wages go up as the job situation improves.
Steve Deller joins us now to help sort things out. He's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me back.
Let's start with the raw unemployment numbers lately. How are we doing in Wisconsin?
Actually, we're doing quite well. We're at a level of unemployment that is indicative of a labor shortage. And I think that that is something that many employers are struggling with, is finding workers able to fill the job openings that are there. So it is a good problem to have.
What's driving that?
I think a lot of it is that we are starting to see job recovery in the state. It's been a slow time coming, but we are back above where we were before the Great Recession. And the problem that we're having is that as the baby boomers kind of retire out and leave the labor force, we're not seeing an influx of people moving into the state to take those jobs. So part of it is a demographic kind of bubble phenomenon that's occurring. And part of it is we're just not attracting migrants to come into the state.
Now, overall, this declining unemployment number, how much of this is a Wisconsin story and how much of it is just a national trend where we've had, what, 80 plus straight months with job growth?
Well, you do have to remember that the state's economy does reflect what's happening with the national economy. We can kind of describe how we're doing better in some areas and worse in some areas, but you really do have the national economy that's driving this thing. But we do have really very, very low unemployment rates compared to the national average and to a lot of our neighboring states.
And now the other side of this has been out in the news lately. Wages, Wisconsin, compared to other states, I understand, not doing terribly on wage growth. But when you look at low-income jobs, really not seeing a lot of wage growth there.
That's true. One of the sectors that generally has been a strength for Wisconsin in terms of refining solid, good-paying jobs is manufacturing. And while manufacturing jobs are still very good-paying, we're not seeing a lot of growth in those types of jobs. Where we are, and the other sector is kind of the information sector, business services, sectors like that, that tend to be higher-paying. We're not seeing a tremendous amount of growth in those kind of jobs. What we are seeing growth in is more the personal services type jobs, and they tend to be a little bit lower paying.
Is there a state where we're getting, as you say, there's a labor shortage in effect? Shouldn't, if there's this demand for labor, shouldn't wages be going up to lure people in? Or is it the case that maybe these low-wage jobs are in fields where the margins are so low that there's no wiggle room for employers to pay more.
Well, that's one of the problems that we're facing. You're right. In the classroom, you would say we should see wages starting to pick up. The question, though, is that you have to look at where within the state you're talking. In Madison, for example, we're seeing historically low unemployment rates, and you're seeing wages bid up for that. But you can go in other parts of the state and you don't see that phenomenon occurring because there's just not that much stress. Part of the problem that we have in Wisconsin is that so many of our larger employers are in what we call the commodity market. Think yellow corn number two. It's just whatever the market determines. A lot of our manufacturers are in that market, which means that their margins are really very, very thin. So even if they wanted to raise wages, they can't really afford to do it.
So are these the other answer, if you can't afford labor, in a lot of cases, is more automation? Is that something we're seeing in these lower-paying jobs?
I think you are seeing more of that. I think one of the things that you look at manufacturing from a national perspective, and Wisconsin is a reflection of this to a large extent, is that if you look at like gross domestic product and the contribution of gross domestic product, manufacturing is doing very well, thank you very much. But employment is not tracking in the same way. And it's simply because of automation. You can now have an automobile plant that produces 100,000 cars, and you have a fraction of the labor force that was required 30 years ago.
Talking to Steve Deller, economics professor at UW-Madison, looking at the latest jobs outlook in Wisconsin. And speaking of those high-tech factory jobs that are replacing maybe the lower-skilled labor, it's providing jobs for a different group of people now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's also, I mean, when you see some of these lower-paying jobs, it's really difficult to retain some of those workers. You see a high turnover rate with a lot of these jobs. You will find that if I'm making $10 an hour with no benefits and I find another job on the other side of town that's paying $1 or $10.50, I'm gone. And it creates a lot of expenses for businesses to have to deal with that kind of turnover. It's an expense that they really don't want to face, but they can't afford to go to $11 an hour.
And how about those automated jobs we keep hearing about? Okay, we're going to have this manufacturing, but it's high tech. We're going to need more skilled people. How is the state doing at keeping up with that kind of demand?
Again, it depends on where you are in the state. I mean, there's a lot of educational opportunities across the state, particularly with the technical colleges and some of the two-year campuses that are able to provide some of this specialized training. Some of the industries in the state have also, like the Plastics Council in the central part of the state, has been very effective of working with the technical schools to come up with specific customized training for their workforce needs. But it used to be that, having a high school degree and getting a job making $30 an hour at a manufacturing firm, those jobs are kind of gone. And they're really not coming back. Having some kind of post-secondary education, you don't need to have a degree, but having some kind of training in computer science or basic engineering skills or mathematics, those are becoming necessary.
I want to get into a big hypothetical story now, Steve. This Foxconn, this huge technology company looking apparently to open a big plant in the United States, probably the Midwest, maybe Wisconsin. Talk about the Racine area in particular. What are you looking at in that story?
Lots of maybes in that. Mm-hmm. I think what's happening here is that Foxconn is looking at a traditional kind of manufacturing type area that has the technical skills to match what they need. I think that what they're probably looking at is they want into the Chicago market, but they don't want in Illinois because Illinois has lots and lots of problems that raises lots of uncertainty that businesses don't like. So moving across the border into Wisconsin may make perfect sense for them. They can tap into that Chicago area market, particularly the northern suburbs, and tap into the manufacturing tradition of the Milwaukee area.
Job numbers supposedly in the thousands. a labor shortage in the state, a skill gap supposedly in the state? Can Wisconsin provide the people, Foxconn would need?
Well, it depends on how you define the labor market. How far are you willing to tap into people coming in from Illinois? A lot of it's going to depend on the transportation infrastructure system. Can we get the workers to those jobs? And not necessarily picking up and moving into Racine, but rather, you know, I work in Wheeling, Illinois. Can I get to those jobs? And it's going to hinge on the transportation system.
Steve Deller's with us, economics professor at UW-Madison, looking at jobs in Wisconsin with low unemployment but stagnant wages at the low end of the pay scale, and maybe this Foxconn plant, hypothetically, shaking things up with a factory in the Racine area.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you looking for a job now? Are you seeing good options out there? If you're hiring people, is it hard to find qualified candidates? If you work in lower-paying jobs, have you seen any improvements? And if you are in the Racine area, what are you thinking about the Foxconn story? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing our conversation with economics professor Steve Deller from UW-Madison, looking at low unemployment numbers in the state and stagnant wages for people at the lower end of the pay scale in Wisconsin.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions, especially if you're looking for a job or looking for people to fill jobs. What are you seeing out there? And if you're at the lower end of the pay scale, have you seen a boost in pay lately or not so much? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we get to our callers, Steve, just wanted to ask more about the low-wage workers. People have been pointing out it's not just about the pay. There are other challenges often facing people going to these jobs.
That's right. For a lot of the larger employers that are paying these lower wages, they have expectations on their workers that sometimes is not conducive to that particular labor market. For example, in the $10 an hour pay scale, you may have a lot of single parents that are trying to put together a number of jobs. And when you have a single parent and a child is sick, you may be late for work. You may miss work. Some of the work requirements essentially say you miss work more than number of days in a certain period of time, you're fired. You also have a drug, a lot of the workers, as a lot of the employers are saying that they're having a harder time finding people that pass the drug tests. And, you know, that's a whole nother issue that can create problems at that lower end of the pay scale. A third problem that's happening with this lower pay is the kind of the lack of pay raises and whatnot. This starts to affect how people spend their money. If you haven't had a pay raise or a significant pay raise in the past few years, it affects how you spend money. And we kind of get ourselves into a trap where if I'm not getting a pay raise, then I'm going to start scaling back on my spending. I'm not going to buy that new washer and dryer. I'm not going to buy that new refrigerator. I'm not going to buy that new car because I'm not seeing any pay raises. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Rachel joins us in Racine. Rachel, hi.
Hi. So I work for a temporary labor company. We mostly have unskilled workers working in various manufacturing facilities in southeastern Wisconsin. And a lot of what I'm seeing is some of it is, you know, companies are still thinking that they can pay $8.25, you know, up to $9 an hour and still get quality people, which is very difficult in this labor market. The other thing I'm seeing from the opposite side is people who are not willing to put in the work, people who say that, you know, they make more money off of unemployment, or if they work over X amount of hours, then they lose their health care, their badger care. And then people who just walk off the job because it's hard or they get sweaty. So we're really having a difficult time finding people.
Rachel, thanks a lot for that call. So she's seeing unrealistic expectations from both sides, maybe employers and employees.
I think you're right. And let me take the first part first. I was at a workshop a while back, and there was a representative from one of the Small Business Administration offices that kind of said, well, I have two kind of clients that think that their employees are their best assets and will do anything to make sure that their employees are happy, and those who think that employees are an unnecessary evil that I have to pay to be functioning. I think those latter employers are probably going to have a hard time. But I also think that you're right. There is I'm not sure you want to call it a work ethic issue. But there are, when you're paying $8, $9, $10 an hour, my motivation for really kind of exerting myself and working hard is pretty low. And we do have a problem with our benefit system. I was just talking to a colleague today, is that we have, the way that we have our system set up is that you can earn so much money up to a certain point. And then once you hit that point, you lose all your benefits. What is my incentive to go above that point? Another way to do it would be say, okay, once you hit that point, what we start doing is that we start proportionally taking away some of those benefits so that it's not a yes-no type thing.
So it's not that perverse incentive to keep people from working. We heard from Richard on Facebook. Richard says, the situation's pretty desperate in Barron and Washburn counties. Jobs paying over $10 an hour to start are going unfilled week after week. So those are not high-paying jobs necessarily, but I think lower cost of living areas in the state. What do you know about counties like Barron and Washburn?
It's a hit and miss. I mean, you do have situations, particularly when you have seasonal tourism-type jobs, that you will end up with a shortage. And a lot of these firms simply cannot pay much more than that. They can't afford to pay much more than that. And they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Let's take another caller now. Julia with us in Madison. Julia, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes, I'm a state of Wisconsin employee, and I'm coming up on 9 years. And I have not had a pay raise in 9 years. I think shortly after I came on board, there was a 10-cent raise. I supervise 30 people, and we were just notified a couple months ago that Scott Walker is going to be kind to us in looking at election year, and he's going to give us a pay increase of 2%. A lot of people think that, you know, state workers are overpaid, but me, myself, and I'm not alone in our agency, we have not seen anything in 9 years, and, you know, it makes it really difficult to get by on not even an increase in living wage.
Julia, thanks for calling. The state a major employer in the state. How does Wisconsin's salary affect the overall trends here, Steve?
It does. I think it goes back to my earlier comment about people that go for long periods of time and don't get any kind of pay raises. Their motivation for being productive at work starts to drop off. And also it affects their spending. Like I say, they won't go out and make those purchases that help spur the economy along because they're just not seeing themselves moving forward.
Julia, thanks for the call. Briefly, as we wrap up, Steve, what is the next bit of information or trend that you're watching for in Wisconsin's job market?
I think what's happening is that we're moving from a fair economy to a good economy. The Bankers Association of Wisconsin just put out a survey of banking CEOs, and on a scale of how's the economy doing right now, on a scale of excellent, good, fair, poor, 3 out of 4 are saying we're doing good. Only 10%, which is probably a small number, say that we're doing excellent. So I think we're moving from the poor performance to the good performance, but we're not busting the seams yet.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Steve Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. You can find more on this and related issues at wiscontext.org/money.
Across Wisconsin, the number of opioid overdoses more than doubled to nearly 3,000 in 2014. In the third and final installment of a series on the toll opioids are taking on Wisconsin families, Kyla Calvert-Mason reports on the impact the crisis is having on child protective services.
This winter, a 911 call in Waukesha County drew national attention.
What's going on?
I think my dad's dead.
He's
not waking up for anything.
The boy was calling from a cell phone inside his father's car.
Okay, is it just you two in the by the car?
No, it's all three of us. My two brothers and my dad.
Emergency responders arrived minutes later, and the father of the three boys, ages 4, 6, and 8, survived what turned out to be an overdose. The calls that come after emergencies like these are becoming routine for Vicki Smith. She oversees foster care for Waukesha County. She says they've always gotten calls about parents who are intoxicated or high.
What's been happening recently is that a parent is overdosing either on heroin or opiates. We have had quite a few kiddos who have found their parents unconscious, and those kiddos have been the ones who have had to call law enforcement.
The severity of the cases when we're actually getting them are increasing.
That's Kathy Maluli, who heads child services for the county.
We need to go out right away, within 24 hours, provide for safety of those kids. That type of work has increased as well.
Dedicated staff answer incoming calls all day long.
All right, that's all the information I need right now.
When an investigation finds reason to intervene, the case is assigned to a social worker like Linda Sanger. Sanger's been doing this work for more than 25 years.
7, 8 years ago is when I think it really started hitting us, the prescription medication. I've seen that for a significant amount of time, but now in the past few years, heroin is all we're seeing. The majority of my caseload currently, other than maybe a couple cases, it's heroin.
She manages about 9 cases at a time. Each one can involve 2 or more parents and multiple children placed in multiple foster homes. And she says she's not reaching the resolutions she used to.
It's a tougher issue to deal with than treatment-wise. We're not seeing the success stories that we did with years ago. Somebody who's addicted to cocaine. This is a different animal here.
A recent Wisconsin Counties Association report found rising turnover among Child Protective Service workers due to larger caseloads and exposure to traumatic scenes. Still, Sanger says it isn't always bleak. There are cases that end with reunified and stabilized families.
Those few cases that I've had were heroin addict mother able to turn around, support.
But support services can be hard to come by. And Maluli says the stressful reality is that limited county funds have to serve residents with a wide variety of needs.
To provide the same type of quality service, the same safety nets that we put in place for the public are expensive and important, and you know, we want to do things right.
But Sanger worries about the long-term costs of not being able to give families the support they need.
Our kids need permanence. Our kids are losing parents, not just to addiction itself, but because their parents are dying. And I don't have an answer, but I can just say it's not from where I'm sitting. It's not getting better.
The county's association called for a $13.5 million increase to state funding for child and family aides over the next 2 years to meet those needs. The governor and state legislators agreed to a funding hike of $6.25 million instead. Kyla Calvert-Mason, Wisconsin Public Radio.